This is Car Expert.
The fact that this tiny little crossover was doing about 180 on the main straight, it's insane how quickly this thing picks up speed.
There's some interesting bits and pieces there that go the other way and kind of make the C4 feel a bit special and different to the rest of the crowd.
How do you feel about BMW M? They release a bespoke product and it's an SUV.
I feel the same way as I felt when I saw a Turbo S badging on the back of a Taycan.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner. G'day, Albors fella.
Hey, mate, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to have you back on. And William Stopford, hello.
Hey, Mandy.
We thought we might actually start this week's podcast off by talking about a brand that Bors, that you own. You own a Lotus Elise. And Will, you're probably more suited to maybe have a chat about this, and I'd love to hear the opinion of Albors as well. We've seen a teaser shot of the Lotus Type 132 SUV, and it's just sort of in a like taken like a silhouette style. Can't really see too much, but can you fill us in a little bit more, Will? And then I want to hear from Albors about this.
Yeah, so they teased kind of the front ends of all their upcoming models a little while ago, and then they've just done this little teaser video campaign where it's two people staring longingly at each other interspersed with shots of the actual car that don't really show all that much. But we know it's got active aero, it's got active grille shutters, and, you know, a LiDAR sensor, and actually a kind of cool tablet-style touchscreen that just kind of flips out from the dashboard in a way that I cannot adequately explain. But basically, Lotus is owned by Geely, and they're planning a huge product offensive of electric vehicles. So the Type 132 SUV is going to be like their rival for the Porsche Cayenne, and it's set to be revealed in 2022. Then there's going to be a four-door coupe, roughly the size of a Mercedes CLS in 2023. Then a smaller SUV in 2025, and then, you know, finally an electric sports car in 2026. So Lotus hasn't forgotten its roots. But the four new electric models that are being launched over the next 5 years, they're going to be built at a new factory in Wuhan in China that's set to be completed later this year. And Lotus is rolling out four new platform architectures. So you've got Hypercar, which is used by the Via. Did I say that right?
Is it a Via? Is it a Vija?
I don't pronounce the J because I just read it as a Spanish name, but I don't think it is. It's
don't worry, no one's buying that car. It's super rare.
Yeah. But also a sports car platform that's used by the Emira, which Bors is getting, an eSport platform that's going to be used by Lotus and Alpine sports cars, and then premium that's going to be used by everything else. Now, I know that a lot of this information, like the technical specifications, have been released a little while ago, but I just thought, seeing as we've got Bors on the podcast, what are your thoughts about a Lotus electric SUV?
I mean, firstly, this kind of reminds me a little bit of the Danny Bahar era of Lotus.
Oh, God.
Where I remember being at Geneva Motor Show and he unveiled like 16 cars in 1 minute. I don't know if they were made out of cardboard or actually they were real, but he actually went over his allocated time and then the next guy started talking over him and he just kept talking because he just had more cars to keep unveiling. And I mean, Danny Bahar went on to build his house using Lotus money, allegedly. It doesn't work for Lotus anymore, but that was a very strange period of Lotus. And I hope that this is real. I'm sure it is, obviously. It's got a different ownership and a lot more money, but it is a bit strange to see Lotus do anything outside of an Elise and an Exige, I suppose. But like Will said, it's a whole new era for the company. I don't understand the concept of a Lotus SUV, but a lot of people said the same about Porsche. So it's really got to be... It's got to be good and it's got to be different. Otherwise, I just don't think any existing Lotus customer would buy a Lotus SUV necessarily because it's Lotus. So if you're going to attract new buyers to the brand, you're going to have to offer something that you don't get from a Mercedes or a Porsche or something like that. And I'm not really sure what that would be. It would have to be design almost. Like the reason I bought the Emira was because it looks unreal. Like that Emira in that blue.
Yeah.
With the black pack, just it actually looks better than most, you know, modern supercars that cost, you know, three or four times the money. So maybe if they could apply that level of design to the SUV, then yeah, maybe it would sell, you know.
Do you think Lotus has got, obviously it's a very, very, very old brand, but do you think it's got the same kind of cachet as Porsche did in the early 2000s when they started building SUVs?
Absolutely not. Exactly. Lotus has usually been, you know, glued together with fiberglass, and I just, my Elise has been at the Lotus dealer for about 4 weeks getting his aircon fixed for the sixth time. You know, that's well and good on a track car that I use once a month maybe, but if my SUV didn't have its aircon fixed after 6 weeks, I'd be a little bit, you know, it'd be a little bit different. But I think as these cars come out, obviously the brand will have to mature. But I don't know. It the problem is it doesn't make sense for a company like Lotus to exist to just make low volume sports cars. It's non, as a business, it doesn't make sense. It can't exist on its own, and therefore, as the same reason that Porsche banned an SUV, they have to produce something at scale to pay for the sports cars. It's just basic business practice for those car companies. So it's not like they have a choice, right? They have to make a volume car. And I guess that's an SUV, as that happens to be all the fad at the moment. It has been for the last decade or two. I just, like Will said, I'm just not sure if the brand can carry it, but I hope it can because Lotus is awesome. And I hope that they can stick around for as long as possible.
And they've got Geely money, and Geely will probably throw a lot of money at it.
The thing that also concerns me is the bit about them being made in China, and obviously that's not an issue because a lot of Chinese cars are really built properly now, but when you're buying a Porsche SUV, you're still buying a Porsche, and it's sort of built where Porsches are made usually. But you know, the Lotus sports cars are coming out of the UK, but if the Lotus SUV is coming out of somewhere else, it would have to be priced accordingly, in my opinion. You know, you can't be charging high-end European pricing for a Chinese made SUV with a Lotus badge. You know what I mean? I just, you know, I hope that doesn't sound bad, but I guess it does. I kind of get my point, right? If Porsche started making the Cayenne in China, I wouldn't be wanting to be paying that premium for it. It's much in the same way that I wouldn't be paying that premium for Polestar. If there's a Chinese made Polestar coming, I don't want to be paying the same amount of money for it as a Swedish made Polestar. Just simple economics. If they're getting a massive discount, I want to have that passed on to me. So anyway, go Lotus.
Indeed. All right, well, we'll get stuck into car news. I'm actually going to talk about a concept SUV as well. Will, it's over to you. It looks like Nissan is going to spend billions on their electrification plans over the coming years.
Yeah, so as we keep seeing with car companies, if they're not doing this, they're doing something wrong. Car companies lately have been announcing huge investments into electrification and in technology and battery technology, et cetera. So Nissan is the latest to do a big presentation about it. So they are spending $24.6 billion on electrification over the next 5 years. Now, you just have to remember that Nissan was probably one of the earliest car companies to get into the EV space with the Leaf. But it took them a really long time to really follow up to that. So the Ari is coming soon, although still has not been confirmed, locked in for a launch date for Australia. But basically what Nissan is calling their Ambition 2030 vision, we'll see it bring 23 electrified models. So that includes 15 new battery electric vehicles, and the rest will be mostly e-power vehicles, to market by fiscal year 2030. They're also the latest company to announce that they're getting into solid-state batteries. We've seen a lot of news on the solid-state battery front with Mercedes-Benz, Hyundai, Kia, Stellantis, I'm forgetting a couple others, but all announcing that they're investing in a particular solid-state battery startup in the States called Factorial Energy, and we know Toyota's bringing out solid-state batteries. So this is the kind of next frontier when it comes to batteries, and we're seeing basically every company say, yeah, sure, we'll bring them out. Over the next 5 years, Nissan's introducing 20 new models with electric or e-power powertrains. So basically, it wants to have an electrification mix within that time of more than 50% globally across both the Nissan and Infiniti brands. Now, Nissan also took this opportunity to preview four concepts. Now, one of them will look familiar because it's actually they gave us a better view at what's replacing the Leaf. So they've previously teased this pretty funky looking, honestly handsome looking electric crossover. And this time around, they've called it the the chill out. Wait until you hear the other ones, Mandy. Go on. But it's going to share its CMF EV platform with the Aria, and also the dual motor all-wheel drive system in the Aria, which Nissan calls, and this is like this is like a Fast and Furious sequel name. They call it E-Force. That sounds normal. However, the F is actually a 4. So it's really more like E4 Ors. Anyway. utterly stupid. Anyway. Nissan's also previewed 3 other concepts. So they've not released too many details on these concepts other than they're a look beyond the current CMF EV architecture. So they kind of give you an idea of what's coming down the line with an advanced E-Force all-wheel drive system, cut, and advanced ProPilot driver assist features. So they are the Max Out, which is this convertible thing, for lack of a better word.
I don't know how I feel about that. The looks of it.
You'd think of all of them that the convertible would be the coolest looking.
Yeah, it's not.
And the fact that it's called Max Out makes me think, is that like a nod to the Maxima? So it's supposed to be like one of the larger vehicles. It's supposed to be kind of a flagship. But, I mean, you can fold the passenger seat flat. It's very concept-y. So I don't see that anything like that coming to market. The other two seem a little bit more production viable, shall we say, if not anywhere near production ready. The Surf Out, which that doesn't really surf out, doesn't that doesn't make sense. Anyway, it's an electric ute, pretty funky looking electric ute with a focus on off-road ability. And then you've got the Hangout, which actually looks like kind of normal. It's an electric people mover concept. It's got a completely flat floor from front to back.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Will. Is Nissan being ran by Danny Bahar or is this real?
these are just tasters for what's to come.
I mean, if we all sat around a table and paid a designer to come up with some CGIs, we could announce 7 cars in the next 5 years too. Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, but this is the thing, though. I think
I can announce now that Car Expert is going to invest $25 billion into EVs over the next 10 years, and we've got all these 75 models that I'm going to draw on a piece of paper by tomorrow.
But see, it's all well and good, though, to say we're announcing a big spend in electrification. We're going to do this. We're going to do solid-state batteries and all of that. But to actually kind of get people's eyeballs, you need to give them pictures. And I know that these are just renders and they are very rendered. But
they look nice.
Yeah.
But do you guys remember Elon Musk and his robot guy? He's like, we're announcing we're building a robot and it's just a guy in a suit. This kind of looks the same thing.
Anyway. these are really just to kind of give you an idea of, I guess, perhaps the design language more so than anything else and what they're planning on doing in the future. So Nissan expects, it understands that some markets are going to take to electrification more quickly. So by fiscal year 2026, it expects electrified vehicles, so not just electric, but also their e-power kind of hybrid models, to account for more than 75% of its sales in Europe, more than 55% in Japan, and more than 40% in China. So you can see that Europe's pretty far ahead of the curve when it comes to EVs. It plans on producing solid-state batteries at a pilot plant as early as 2024 and introduce them in 2028. And it's working to, at some unspecified time in the future, achieve cost parity between EVs and petrol vehicles. Well, aren't they all? And cobalt-free battery technology. A way of bringing down the cost of battery production. That's really, it's a lot of pretty renders, but there's also a lot of really tangible plans for what Nissan wants to do. And I think, they've kind of sat down after releasing the Leaf, and the Leaf, to its credit, was around years before anybody else, before very most other manufacturers had an EV. Yeah. And it was the world's best-selling EV for a while. But now Tesla's, come and taken the ball and run with it. And so Nissan's got to play catch-up, which perhaps it should have planned for. But that's another story. So that is Nissan's electrification efforts.
Very cool. Well, we're going to look to BMW's efforts now. The first M concept has been revealed for the first time in decades, Elbors. It's called the XM. What are your thoughts on the looks of it?
Oh, I don't know if this show is rated for my real thoughts on the looks of it. I don't even know what to say about that grill. It looks like my son drew it, you know, like, and he's a pretty good drawer, but that front end design, it looks very unique. It's probably the best way I could describe it. But, you know, like I like it though. I like that BMW at least try and be different. Because, you know, at least it's not like another Audi where it just all looks the same. Like, no, but seriously though, like, you know what I mean? Like, I love Audis, I love BMWs, but man, like, they've got to have some balls to do something a little bit different. But I like the engine. You know, it's very rare you get a brand to come up with something that announcing new and it starts with a V8 petrol engine, like with 550 kilowatts and 1,000 new meters of torque. Now, I don't know if that's going to actually make it in that form to production. I'd love to see that happen. Who knows? But 80K of electric range as well. So, you know, I guess that'll get past all the emission stuff in Europe. So they might be able to make it a reality. I'd love to know how much this is going to cost, though, because it looks bloody expensive from these concept photos. So I'm assuming it's going to sit well and truly above the highest spec X7 and X8 if they ever bring that out and just be like some ridiculous.
Well, this is what we
thought. This is the X8, right?
Yeah, this is what we thought was going to be called the X8, and then they decided to name it after an old Citroën for some reason.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because it is an X BMW.
Look at that rear.
But it's also
crap. What has gone wrong there? What is
the side profile too? I don't know about the side profile.
That rear actually looks like a Genesis, but except the exhausts look bizarre. Like, don't you reckon the rear looks like a bit of a Genesis? Like straight on the back. It's got that GV7080 like look to it. I don't know.
I'll humor you.
Yeah, man, it's out there. I'll give him that. It's out there.
What
I
about
love
this
the interior.
Weird roof?
No, I love the roof. I love the interior. It's very like, I just want like when you open the doors for smoke to come out. That would really complete the look of this car. It is right up my alley, but I know that by the time it gets to production, it'll probably look like another X3.
Well, look, we've seen spy photos where it's been heavily camouflaged, but you can see that this is pretty much what it's going to
you
look
reckon?
Like. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be massive differences. But how do you feel, Albors, as somebody who loves supercars, that this is actually the first bespoke BMW M product since the original M1. How do you feel about BMW M now in the 21st century? They release a bespoke product that's not just based on a regular BMW product and it's an SUV.
I feel the same way as I felt when I saw a Turbo S badging on the back of a Taycan. I think that it's the sign of the times, unfortunately. I think brands, as we discussed about Lotus prior, they've got to survive, they've got to sell cars. People want these things. People want an SUV. I want one of these things, frankly. So, you know, I mean, it's a cool story, but really, the original BMW M1, I mean, that's out of this world stuff. No one's going to look at this in 50 years and go, oh, remember that XM? Like, you're not going to find this in Lindsay Fox's museum. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I reckon the looks of it is just begging to be pimped out, don't you think?
Oh,
giant rims on it, and
it's come pre-pimped.
Need what else?
It's already got 23 inch alloys.
I have never seen a modified car with exhaust that ugly in my life, so someone could probably fix it.
Mandy, it's come pre-pimped because it's got velvet seats and 23 inch wheels. Girl, how much more do you want?
You're so very correct.
Yes.
God. Okay, let's talk about a car that's already on the road, shall we, Will? Honda Civic pricing and specs. We're also going to touch on the Civic Hybrid, the Type R and the HRV a little bit later on, but let's start with the Civic.
Yes, our man Scott Colley got a lot of Honda news during the week. I thought we'd do what we love to do on this program and play a little guessing game. Now, you haven't read the article yet, have you, about the Honda Civic price and specs, Mandy?
I didn't look at the price.
You didn't look at the price. Okay. And Albers, you've seen the price, haven't you? Yeah, you have. Yeah, so
I think someone told me while I was driving and I nearly crashed the car.
So that should give you a hint, viewers, for those listening at home. Mandy, how much do you think? Now, keep in mind, it's coming here imported from Japan instead of from Thailand. It's in one highly specified hatchback variant, but this is not the Type R. The Type R and the hybrid Civics are coming next year. How much do you think this one Civic is drive away?
Drive away. I'm thinking I'm maybe like 31. No. Oh, wow.
Is it 31?
The naivety of youth.
More.
Really?
Much like, more.
Like 39?
Oh, more.
You're kidding me. We're not pushing like mid-40s, are we?
Oh, we're pushing past it. 47,200 drive away. Now, there are no options except for color, and Honda's servicing is very cheap.
You know what? Why isn't it just not free, the Honda service?
Yeah, I mean, God.
Yeah.
It's $120 a service.
That's like nothing.
Like,
yeah.
At that point, when you're charging 50 grand for a Honda Civic, just make it free.
Yeah, it would be a nice little offer, wouldn't it? Oh, free servicing. Well, I might pay $47,000 for a Civic then.
Well, I'm not going to pay otherwise, but this might convince me to at least consider it.
This is what, look, all things in perspective. Its drive-away price, because Honda only does drive-away pricing now with this new agency model, does put it up against the likes of the Volkswagen Golf R-Line. Now, that's not to say that that's a particularly cheap vehicle, but it's not completely crazy. It does undercut base BMW 1 Series and Mercedes-Benz A-Class hatchbacks. I'm not sure that's much of a brag, is it? If you're, we're slightly cheaper than a base BMW. But the unfortunate thing is, for all intents and purposes, this new Civic looks great. It looks great inside and out. It's probably going to handle well. It's probably going to drive well. CVT is not my thing, but Honda knows how to do a well-sorted powertrain. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, people who have a Civic now, and Honda has conceded that they're not expecting to sell more than...
You could have just stopped the sentence midway through.
Yeah, they're not expecting to sell. I think it cut out there. No, I didn't.
I was about to press mute on the mic when you said that.
They're only expecting to sell 900 per year. 900, so that's excluding the Type R and the hybrid. So that is a very realistic goal because Ford sold more Focuses this year before they basically canned half the range. So I get that. But the thing is, think about all the loyal Honda buyers out there who have probably been buying Hondas for years because Honda has made great products over the years. They're going to go into a showroom and they're going to walk in and they'll say, oh, I just love my Civic. I'd love to get a new Civic. How much do they start at? I don't know why this person is old, but they're going to ask that and they're going to be told 47,000 drive away. Oh, don't you have a cheaper one? No, we don't.
He does the old person voice. I do. Really, yes. Well. I'm kind of worried about it.
I can do an old man voice and an old lady voice, but this, anyway. But basically, Honda's not going to have any affordable Civic options. Now, their range has already been kind of trimmed further because, you know, they're losing the Odyssey next year because global production is ending. They won't bring the Jazz here. We're not getting the City Sedan anymore. So it's a very tight range here. Now, Honda's done this before in positioning itself as a more premium Japanese brand than the likes of, you know, Nissan or Mitsubishi. But it's a very weird pivot to go from pretty sharply priced Thai-built models, which, to be fair, a lot of people were saying, oh, go back to Japanese sourcing. Oh, no, Thai Honda's rubbish, blah, blah, blah. They're doing this, but then also pivoting to this very premium pricing. And I'm very concerned with how the HRV range is going to look pricing-wise because they haven't announced pricing yet. They have said that they're going to offer more than just one variant, because that's a very Citroen thing to do. Well, we'll come back to that later. It's a good car, but, you know, not having that kind of price leader model is very puzzling. Now, there's other news that's come out of Honda. So we know that the Civic VTI LX hatch is going to be joined by one of the Civic EHEV hybrids. Oh, I hate those acronyms. Now, that's expected to use the same powertrain as the HRV-EHEV.
God, really?
Oh, no, you know, just call it a HRV hybrid. Don't do this nonsense. Anyway, so it's expected to have
E-column-HEV, sorry.
You gotta say. Well, I don't know if you have to pronounce the colon. Well, it breaks it up a little bit.
Yeah.
HRV-E-colon-HEV. Sounds like a movie. HRV-E.
HEV.
What do you drive? I don't even know.
I drive. You know what they do? You know why they do this? And actually, funny that you mentioned that. Not to go off topic here, but my understanding is Honda with the Legend. They sold that in the US as an Acura, and they sold it successfully for two generations. Everyone knew what an Acura Legend was, especially Ludacris. But they decided, hey, no, for the next generation, we're going to rename it. We're going to call it the Acura RL. Now, I don't even know what that stands for. And everyone's like, why did you get rid of the Legend name? And apparently it was because, now this might be apocryphal, so feel free to fact check me on this, but they did it because you're more likely then to say, instead of saying an RL, because people won't know what that is, you'll say an Acura RL, or you'll just say an Acura. So it's really just kind of getting people to say the brand name instead of, because then people knew Legend more than Acura. Anyway, way off topic. That a hybrid model's coming. Honda is committed to having a hybrid version of every new model that it launches in Australia. 96 kilowatts of power and 253 newton meters of torque in the HR-V, EHEV, and likely in the Civic as well. So a little bit less power than the petrol Civic, but a little bit more torque. And Honda said that they're targeting a Toyota rivaling price gap between the petrol and hybrid. So you'd be looking at maybe like a premium of like $2,000 to $3,000. You would be looking at probably 50,000 drive away or just under for a Civic Hybrid when it does come out. The Type R is really the most exciting Civic, and we've seen some spy photos of that. We're expecting to see an updated version of the current turbo 2-litre four-cylinder with 228 kilowatts of power and 400 newton meters of torque. But perhaps the most important model launch for Honda in Australia next year will be the new HR-V. Don't know how much it's going to cost. And we don't have specifications yet, but that's going to be a very important model because the brand expects 90% of its sales to be made up of SUVs moving forward. Exactly. And moving forward, it's looking at potentially adding a third SUV model, which would likely be a smaller one to slot in under the HR-V. So it looks like there's a couple of options from Honda's global portfolio it could tap into. The most likely one is it's been previewed as the SUV RS concept, and Honda has trademarked the ZR-V badge. I imagine there'll probably be a ZR-V:HEV too. But what there won't be for at least 18 months is any Honda electric vehicle. So we are still no closer to getting the Honda e hatchback, which everybody thinks is so funky and cool. Basically Honda has just said electric's on its radar, opening, you know, having sourcing from Japan will open up some doors. It's part of our plan, but it's just not yet, basically. And they've said that, you know, Stephen Collins, the boss of Honda locally, has said, you know, the electric car market is clearly growing rapidly, but it's growing rapidly off a very, very low base. There's a race to bring electric cars to market, but in the whole scheme of things, the numbers are still relatively small. So I wouldn't be holding my breath on seeing the Honda E anytime soon.
Pity.
So,
yeah, all right. A big, big week for Honda there. We're going to end with some Hyundai news, boys. We've got the price and specs for the i30 sedan N.
Yeah, before this podcast started, I was sort of having a look at this article and debating with Will whether or not this car looks good or not. What do you reckon, Manny? Do you reckon it's a good-looking car?
No.
What?
Yeah, see, no. I thought you were wrong.
Gorgeous.
I actually admit the spoiler helps it a little bit. But no.
Oh, well, the color hinders it. I know it's their iconic Hyundai N color, but no, it's just.
I thought it was going to be one of those cars where it would look better in person. And I've seen them on the road, and I'm still like, nah.
Wow.
I know it's really harsh.
Expensive, but, yeah. Hey, like it's. So this is the i30 N sedan, and it's 49 grand, and it's roughly about $5,000 more than the hatch. It's a premium variant, and it doesn't matter if you get the manual or the DCT, it's the same price, which really, really irritates me, because I would, hear me out, right? I would always pick the manual, because I think it's more engaging and better to drive. And I also feel like, you know, it's better value for money. But in this instance, because it's the same amount of money, the tight ass in me would go, I'd rather get the DCT because I know it costs more to make. You know what I mean? A DCT transmission is an 8-speed DCT, a good one anyway. This is probably made by some German company somewhere. Is way more expensive than a 6-speed manual that hasn't changed for 100 years. So to have them at the same price and go, oh, you know, it's the same cost for the DCT. What they've just done is priced the DCT and said, well, if you want a manual, then we'll make another $4,000 out of this.
Are you one of those people who goes to a buffet and just fills their plate so yes. high that it's starting to fall off the side?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And $500 for premium paint, which, you know, at that price point, you might as well just throw that in, right? Now, maybe you get it for free if you're buying a manual. I don't know. $2,000 for sunroof, that's ridiculous. But it's still cheaper than a Golf GTI. So, you know, it's got something going for it. I need to see it in person to know whether I like it or not. But I'm really impressed by the power figures because, you know, 206 kilowatts from a 2-liter engine is pretty impressive. Like just going back 10 years, that was what the WRX STI was putting out from its 2.5, you know, or thereabouts.
Wow.
It went up to about 215, 220 at some point. But like that's not bad. Hey, that's not bad, especially with a DCT gearbox, close to 400 newton meters of torque, 392. I reckon it'll drive pretty well. The wet clutch part of the DCT should suggest that it's going to be pretty reliable. I mean, I know there were some issues with those Tucson DCTs back in the day, but I imagine that's all been fixed by now. So, yeah, $50,000, hey, for an i30N sedan, that's not even on road. That's plus on roads. It's, man, it's expensive. Things are really expensive. I'm really concerned about the state of the world. You got to pay $47,000 for a freaking Civic. In context, this is cheap.
It makes the step up seem very reasonable.
Yeah, in context, this is extremely cheap. But in reality, I can't believe it. I remember reviewing a Golf GTI at $39,990 and thinking, gee, that's a bit expensive. But now it's like mid-50s.
Yeah, back in my day, cars used to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So like, old man yells at cloud.
That's it. Old man yells at cloud.
All right. We'll end news right there. Head to Car Expert if you'd like to know more. Last week, he was here to talk about the Hyundai i20N, and now it's time to shine a light on the Hyundai Kona N. Hello, James Wong.
I'm back again.
Well, we enjoyed the chat last week, so I'm interested to see how the Kona N went around the track. But I suppose before you get into that, how different is the N over the standard Kona?
Very, because it's good. that's a bit of an embellishment. No, so I find that the normal Kona is quite a mixed bag. Because so I've actually had a lot of experience with the Kona because I went to the global reveal back in like 2017 or something. Like I went to Seoul, I did the whole like 30-person media conference. We saw it unwrapped, and they had all the different cars in that massive studio that they've got in Korea. I find that because it's sort of like this weird Frankenstein of like i30 bits and smaller car bits, there's always debate in comments of some of our stories about what it's actually based on. As far as I'm concerned, the executives from Hyundai Global told me it's on like it's based loosely on an i30 platform, which explains a lot of the powertrain and like suspension similarities, and obviously a lot of the tech. So I'll just roll with that. And obviously because they've shoehorned the i30N stuff underneath it, you can see where the links are there, because it's not running an i20N powertrain. But anyway, I digress. The new Kona N is an interesting car because even though it's an SUV, it doesn't have all-wheel drive. It basically is running the exact same stuff that you find in the i30N hatchback and fastback. I won't say the sedan because the sedan's on actually a different platform. So it's priced from $47,500 in standard guise and $50,500 in premium guise. And it's actually around the same or slightly cheaper than the i30 hatch N. And that's more or less because the Kona is sourced out of Korea and not out of Europe like the hatchback is. And unlike the hatchback and the sedan, it doesn't offer the 6-speed manual transmission. So it's DCT only. We did pretty much the same drive that I spoke about last week in the i20N. We had a very lengthy road portion, and then the second day of the event, we did the track component on Wakefield Park Raceway. And obviously, compared having to drive the two cars back to back, which I wasn't actually able to talk about last week because the Kona N was under embargo at the time. Very, very different characters. So the i20N, and even though they're not really the same car, it was just more that I sampled the two together at the same time and then also drove them consecutively on track. The i20 was really fun and it was very raw and it was very engaging, whereas the Kona N is a little bit more of like, I sort of use the term GT or Grand Tour in my review because it's definitely a lot more comfortable. There's a lot more given the suspension. You know, you've got the raised ride height and things like that, but it's not like luxury levels of like comfort and refinement, because obviously this is a powerful, fast car. So it's running the 2-liter turbo that you'll see in most of the other N models, which puts out 206 kilowatts of power and 392 newton meters of torque. And it will do 0 to 100 in a claimed 5.5 seconds, which is very fast, especially for a car that is so small. It sometimes can be a little bit almost scary, and I'll sort of get to that because I've really realized that on the road, the track portion of it. But on the first day, the bulk of the drive route that I took on this with the Kona N was in on the way to Goulburn in regional New South Wales from. What was the place called? I think it was called Berry or something. They have some weird names for towns out there. And so it was where the i20N route sort of took us through some very tight, twisty, foresty stuff. And I'm actually glad that I sort of did the different, because we had to sort of choose which car we drove first. So I think I chose the right portion for each car, whereas the one for the Kona was a little bit more open road and, you know, 100, 110 kilometer an hour winding country roads through like mountain passes and things like that. And I think for that kind of environment, this is a really fun car for that, because you can sort of have your fun and pull the paddles and, you know, go really fast, because the acceleration, this thing, like when I say it doesn't need all-wheel drive, it's so fast and so confidence inspiring that there's just nothing that I haven't really driven anything quite like it. Because it doesn't really have any natural rivals here at the moment. The Volkswagen T-Roc R is not due till next year. And then if you want something like an Audi SQ2, which conceptually is probably the closest in terms of size and performance, it's all-wheel drive. It's about 15 grand more expensive, and the cabin's probably a little bit nicer. But it was just a really nice car and fun car to drive, and like, you know, it's still got that awesome exhaust note with the variable exhaust. You've got the new 8-speed wet clutch DCT. This was my first experience driving an N product with this transmission. They've engineered it, and there's a version of it that's in like the diesel versions of the Kia Sorento and Hyundai Santa Fe. But in this application, it's excellent. I could not catch it out once. It was never, you know, if we stopped at a traffic light and set off or came up to a roundabout, you didn't get that typical hesitation off the line. You didn't get any clumsy shifts from first into second. And I have a pretty high benchmark for these kind of things, because I drive a Golf GTI myself. So I normally use my Golf 7-speed, which is the wet clutch version, as like the benchmark. And this Hyundai transmission, I would probably say, is better. It's incredibly well developed and refined. And I don't know about you guys, whether you've driven a DCT equipped i30N yet, but just the way that everything just sort of came together really, really well. And the Kona N sports seats. Now, I spent most of my time in the normal one. They only had like one premium on the drive, which I drove briefly on the track, and I didn't really notice any real difference. But the seats in the Kona N were super comfortable, and the fact that it has adaptive dampers was really, really helpful on some of the like the transit portions of the road drive, because there were some pretty ugly roads out there in terms of the servicing. So even though it's running like 19-inch wheels and it gets a little bit noisy in terms of tire roll over very rough bitumen, the comfort levels were great. So I was very impressed with the road section of it.
So what about the track part of it? I'm interested to know how it handled corners. Was there much body roll at all? Did it feel like you were driving a crossover?
Yeah, it was really interesting because, you know, I think I've said it many times on the podcast and in various reviews that I've done in the past that I'm not really a fan of performance SUVs. I just look at them and think they're silly, and then rocking up to a racetrack. And Wakefield Park is a pretty tight technical racetrack too. It's not one that you would really, like, I wouldn't be putting an RSQ3 around it with much confidence, for example. So it was the sort of track that you would put an I-20 in or an I-30 in or something like that. So I head out in, did I drive it first or did I drive it second? I can't remember. But I went out there and I was like, okay, this thing I know is pretty fast. I've got the convenience of the paddles, and so I don't have to worry about shifting gears like with a gear stick and clutching and all that kind of stuff. So I sort of just slowly ramped my way up. And even in its firmest setting, you're right, Mandy, there is a little bit of lean. And that was a real stark contrast between the I-20 and the Kona on the day, was that the I-20 just didn't move. It was flat. It gripped up. It was very confidence inspiring. Whereas the Kona didn't make me feel nervous per se, but it does. There's a lot more play in it, and it's got this sort of like, it tests you constantly. It's sort of like, okay, go a little bit harder, but I might trick you into thinking that you're okay, and I might go wash a little bit wide, or, you know, there's a little bit of lean, or, you know, the back might kick out a little bit. And it just was sort of, it was a lot of fun, but it wasn't especially compared to the other cars that we were driving on the day, it wasn't the sharpest track tool. And so that would probably be my biggest takeaway from it, is that this thing is blisteringly fast. You put it on a straight and it flies. The fact that this tiny little crossover thingy was doing, you know, about 180 on the main straight of Wakefield Park, it's insane how quickly this thing picks up speed. And, you know, you go through the corner and it's got the same electronically controlled mechanical slip diff as the I-30N. So it really does hook up. There was rarely any occasions where I felt it felt really front wheel drive, like in that it would just understeer and that you'd really have to be careful with how much speed you got into it. I did wash wide on one corner and fall into a mud puddle. So that was fun. But other than that, like it was a lot of fun, and it's very playful. It just feels silly to be driving a car like that. And but it sounds great. It's still a lot of fun. It's obviously not quite as sharp as like an I-30N or an I-20N, but you can take it out on the track and still have a good time. And I think maybe that's what they were really trying to do with this car, is that, you know, it's still got that SUV shape and height and whatever, and that perceived extra practicality that the body style would be known for, but they've injected it with the performance and the sound and, you know, the N experience that sort of makes the other cars really good. I just think that I would probably manage people's expectations by being like, I wouldn't be chasing lap times in this car. You can go on a track and have a really good time, but I don't think you'll be, you know, you won't be overtaking any other N cars unless you're very, very skilled. So I had rally driver Brendan Reeves take me out in a couple of hot laps in the Kona N, same way that he took me out in the I-20, but in the Kona, it was actually his first time driving it when he took me around. So it was really interesting to get his thoughts on it and see how hard he was willing to push it. Now, I had just done my bit and then hit the mud puddle and whatever and washed wide. So I was very, like, you know, feeling sorry for myself. And then the way that he just sort of, like, he'd be like, oh, this is really cool because it's quite fast. And he's talking to me while, like, driving like a maniac. And, like, it was just... There was so much, like, he would get it to drift and he would, like, just throw it around. And then as soon as he got onto a little bit of straight road, he would just fire it. And it's just this, again, it's just that speed that this thing carries, and you're sitting a little bit high. It just feels really weird to go that hard and that fast in a car like that. So,
and drifting in a Kona too, like, that just sounded weird.
Yeah. I think probably a combination of the height and everything, you get a little bit more, the physics of it all. It just sort of likes to kick its back out, and you can get that lift off oversteer and have quite a bit of fun. So yeah, like I said before, it's a lot of fun. And then when you need to do a highway drive like I did, I drove the Kona N back from Wakefield Park to Campbelltown in Sydney southwest. That was the car that I wanted to drive back because it had the really comfy seats, and I put the suspension in soft and everything else in N, so that there was still a lot of noise and, you know, a bit of fun to accelerate if I had to overtake somebody. But it was actually really comfy. So overall, I think it was a really great all-rounder, and I can see that the kind of buyer for this car will likely, they're not going to necessarily go to the track that often. So if it's a daily and everything, it's really great because you have the adjustability of the suspension or the dampers, and you know, it's still got great performance. You fire it up and it makes that great Hyundai N sound that we all know and love. And being an auto, it's also really convenient to use day to day. So some of the purists might go like, well, you know, but at the same time, it's an SUV. So it's not a traditional performance car anyway.
But that said, the worst thing about the Kona is its packaging, and that absolutely carries over to the Kona N. It's barely any more spacious. In fact, it's probably a little bit more cramped than an i30 hatch. And frankly, it doesn't really look all that SUV, conventionally SUV, I should say. So who is actually going to buy a Kona N over an i30N? I imagine a lot of people will, don't get me wrong, but who do you think is the market for the Kona N?
Well, I didn't get an exact demographic or buyer profile off the Hyundai people, but I imagine it would. There are so many people now that they just want an SUV, regardless of whether it's actually an SUV or not. And Kona is a prime. The Kona is a prime example. It is literally a worse packaged i30 that sits about 25-30 mil higher, and. Yep. You know, it's in isolation. It's still a fun little car to drive. It looks cool and whatever. But there are so many people that will walk into a Hyundai showroom and they'd be like, oh, the Kona looks good because I want an SUV. They won't even consider the i30. Yeah. And I think that there's a lot of, not to be sexist, but there's a lot of female buyers that I think would sort of be their train of thought. They want something that sits a bit higher and they feel more secure driving an SUV, and they like the fact that they can say, I have an SUV. But, you know, there's a lot of men that I know as well that would want an SUV as well. So I think it's more that kind of buyer that a passenger car is just not an option. And so they'd walk in and they'd probably walk straight past the i30 hatch end. They think the i30 sedan and looks weird, and then they go straight to the Kona because it looks, you know, it's chunky, it's jacked up. You get a little bit more, you get a better view of the road. But you're right. The back seats are next to useless for someone my size. I'm about 6'1" and a bit, and sitting behind myself for anything longer than, I would say, give it 30 minutes and I'd be pissed off. And Scott and I have been in the back of a Kona as an Uber before, and he was much more uncomfortable than I was. So, you know, that was a 1-hour trip that we'd like to forget. And the boot is also smaller than an i30 hatch N as well, which I note in the actual review, it loses about 20 liters to an i30 hatch. So if you're looking at this being like, oh, it's more practical because it's an SUV, the Kona is a prime example of how usually a passenger car is just as practical, if not more so, than the equivalent SUV. But it's just a silly car, and it looks cool. Like, you look at it, it's got this angry little face, and you can get it in this matte gold color, so it looks like one of those shiny Pokemon that you never find in the video games. And what I'm actually also excited for is that Hyundai is working on like an accessories range for its N cars, and I believe there'll be a lot of things like wheels and interior trimmings and that kind of stuff, where you'll be able to dress it up a little bit and make it your own, because the Kona N was revealed with those forged alloy wheels that the i30 N comes with here now. And they're not a factory option, but I believe that they will be like somewhat of an accessory. So being able to see people, you know, there's a few different color choices. You can dress it up however you like. And if they get a new range of accessories so that buyers can really go nuts with it, I think that just having the choice, I think we've said this before, in that, you know, in whether it's the best thing ever or not, the fact that Hyundai offers now, I think, three cars on that same tier of performance. So you've got the Kona i30 hatch and i30 sedan, and for a limited time you've got the fastback as well. You've got the same car in four different flavors. There's no mainstream manufacturer that really does that, and so it means that, you know, somebody who isn't really fazed by the passenger cars has the option of an SUV now. And it looks cool. It's only a few grand more than an N-line premium Kona, so I don't know why you'd get an N-line premium if you can get this. And it's a lot of fun. So it'd be good to get it through the garage and try it on as a proper daily rather than driving on the roads of windy, because it's not really indicative of what a normal buyer would do. But overall, I was super impressed with the car, and it was just so much fun.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it sounded like you had an absolute ball. That review of the Hyundai Kona N is now up at carexpert.com.au. James Wong, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Let's talk French cars. The new 2022 Citroën C4 is here. And to find out if it's worth its price tag, Scott Colley is here to talk about it because he's reviewed it. Hello, Scully.
Hello, guys. How are we going?
Very good, thank you. So with the C4, what's changed for MY 2022?
Absolutely all of it. This is an all-new model for Australia, and it's got a new look, a new kind of SUV-style design and focus, and a new price tag to go with it. So we've seen a few different variations of Citroën cars in Australia, like the C3 and the C3 Aircross and the C5 Aircross that are all tweaks on previous designs. This car is a new model for them.
Okay, so what is that price tag?
So there is only one model on offer, and it's $37,990 before on-road costs. That is not cheap, I'm sure you'll realise. And it puts it up against cars like the Mazda CX-30, the Kia Seltos with the 1.6-litre turbo engine, and even the Renault Arkana Intense, which kind of looks very similar to the C4 on paper because it's French and a little bit quirky and has a coupe roofline.
Hmm. Hey, Scott, okay. Just excuse my French. Who on earth is buying this car?
It's a really good question, and I've actually started my review by pointing out the fact that Bentley, Lamborghini, and Maserati have all sold more cars than Citroën this year, and even wow. Aston Martin is only two sales behind it. So I think if we wanted to put a positive spin on things, it's someone who wants something really, really unique and individual but at a bargain price. It's a lot cheaper than a Bentayga.
I'm sorry, but we're not gonna be comparing Citroens to Bentaygas here.
I believe
not on my watch.
Tongue was firmly in cheek there, very firmly.
Oh, yes.
The listeners can't see your face, Scott, so, you know, it doesn't come across in your words because I was shocked and horrified to hear that sentence. But anyway.
Well, stay tuned for our comparison between the Urus and the C4 in a couple of weeks' time.
You can get the C4 or you can get the paint option on the Urus. Yeah.
And I think I know which one I'd have, and it's not necessarily the Citroën. I think the other person who would go for the C4, all jokes aside, is someone who either really loves French cars, and those people are out there. I've got family friends who have only owned Peugeots and Citroëns, and they won't bother with anything else, or people who want something nice and comfortable and kind of quirky. What Citroën's done recently is it's made its brand focus on just really plush, really comfortable, really interesting designs. And rather than trying to do the sporty thing like the Germans or the cheaper thing like the Korean and some of the Japanese brands, it's just gone, this is exactly who we are. All of our cars are going to have this distinctive feel and you either love it or hate it. So I think the sort of person buying this car has already owned at least one French car. Because otherwise there's not many Citroën dealers around and the car doesn't get a ton of coverage. There's not a huge model range or anything like that. So it's not going to necessarily be cross-shopped with some of the more rational and popular cars on the market.
It did surprise me when we first published price and specs on the article. I know people like to pick on Citroën because they, you know, get outsold by Ferrari. But there were a lot of people that were saying it is pretty well priced for what you get. Do you think, setting aside the fact that good luck finding a Citroën dealer and good luck seeing any advertising for it, do you think that it does represent good value in this kind of small car, small SUV segment?
I think it's probably priced a little bit higher than it should be. On paper, it's got a really long list of features. And you get some cool stuff like a 10-inch touchscreen. You've got like all the infotainment kit that you'd expect, wired Apple CarPlay, DAB radio. It's got a digital instrument cluster and it looks quite big in the pictures. So it looks like you're getting a lot of metal for your money. In reality, up front, it feels quite big, but a lot of the stuff you see on paper is a variation of Peugeot, Citroën stuff we've had previously that doesn't necessarily feel that premium or expensive. So that 10-inch screen is actually what feels like a 7-inch screen with two permanent climate control displays on either side of it, which is so frustrating because they've got proper dials there. They just haven't bothered changing the software for it. A lot of the materials inside look quite interesting and there's some nice things to touch, but pretty much everything on the dashboard is hard and scratchy. And that reflects the fact that in Europe and in other parts of the world, the C4 starts off as like an entry-level hatchback. And the car that we've got here in Australia would be the equivalent of a top spec model. So it definitely looks like good value when you look at the feature list, but in reality, it doesn't necessarily feel like a a $37,000 or $42,000 or $3,000 car once you pay on-road costs. It kind of feels like an entry-level hatchback that's had a lot of features thrown at it, which in reality is what it is. I think the other thing worth mentioning is, although it's big up front and it's really comfortable, I'd love to talk about the seats and the suspension and all that stuff, but down back, it's really quite tight. I wouldn't want to sit behind anyone reasonably tall. Headroom is really badly impacted by that sloping roofline. And the boot is decent sized, but it's not massive. It doesn't blow you away or, you know, sort of make you go, well, I don't need to buy that larger SUV because it's got a big loading lip and some of the other limitations we've found in other Peugeot Citroën cars on similar platforms.
Does it have that god-awful surround view camera? And for those who can't see, I'm doing inverted commas, that awful 360-degree camera that all the Peugeots have?
It does. So, yeah, most cars with surround view cameras will have a camera under the mirrors and on the front. This car has a camera at the rear and you have to reverse over the ground you're covering and it kind of keeps a memory of it and then gives you a surround view. So you turn the car on and when you don't know where you're actually going or you can't see over your shoulder, you can't see anything because the car hasn't mapped that area yet. So
useless.
Yeah, there's a lot of frustrating bits from the Peugeot Citroën parts bin that carry over here. But I suppose the flip side of that is it's also got some really, really cool features and quirks about it that are typical of Citroën cars. The seats, for example. Citroën talks a lot about the foam they use in there, the design of them, and it all kind of sounds like marketing waffle on paper, and then you sit in them and you kind of sink in and it feels like a really lovely, comfortable armchair. Lots of small cars I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time driving. The C4 I'd happily drive a long way because those seats are just so beautiful and comfortable and they combine really nicely with the way the suspension's tuned to make it feel plush. It doesn't feel like a DS, which is what Citroën has ultimately tried to do with this setup, but it definitely is springier and more comfortable than the average SUV or hatchback at the same sort of price, and that's really kind of cool. I also like that the interior design is quite unique up front. Citroën's put some real thought into making it look interesting. There's lots of storage options, lots of things that flip up and down to hide keys and coins and cards. There's even a pop-out iPad holder for the front passenger. So if you are on a long road trip, I don't know, maybe you've got a kid in the passenger seat, you can click the iPad on there. The airbag fires from the back of the dashboard over the top, which is something they pioneered on the C4 Cactus. So there's some interesting bits and pieces there that go the other way and kind of make the C4 feel a bit special and sort of different to the rest of the crowd, but, yeah, in a good way.
Tell us about the engine.
So it has got a common engine to pretty much everything else we've driven Peugeot Citroën. I realize I'm saying that a bit, but this group is very good at part sharing. It's got a turbo 1.2-litre three-cylinder engine, and it's the more powerful version of that. So it's got 114 kilowatts and 240 newton meters. I suppose another direct comparison to the Bentley Bentayga, this will do it in 8.5 seconds, the 100 kilometer an hour sprint. So it's sort of 4.5, 5 seconds off where it really needs to be to compete with the fastest Bentayga or Urus. But I'd argue that's still fair at around the $40,000 mark.
Back to the drawing board, Citroën.
Yes. Time to start hiring some British engineers with very German names.
I think this is the most anyone's ever talked about a Citroën that's going to sell to 12 people. Hey, like those 12 people are going to be delighted by this review.
I mean, that said, Citroën, they predict that they're going to have more sales next year. Obviously, they're coming from a very low base, but they are expanding the range. And this is kind of tackling two segments at once. But does it work as a small car better than it works as a small SUV, or is it just kind of not really good at either?
I think the first thing to mention there is in the time that I'm sure Albor's, you're the same, but I've interviewed car companies and executives, they very rarely come on the record and say, we plan to go backwards next year. it happens occasionally, but more often than not, they're planning or expecting growth. So for Citroën to say that is awesome, and we know their model range is coming, a broader model range is coming next year, but we're going to have to wait and see on that front because obviously everyone wants to grow, but not everyone can. As a small SUV, the C4 does quite well. You sit quite low in the car, but it still has a little bit of a raised driving position. You're still not going to scrape the nose on driveways and that sort of thing. And even though it's front-wheel drive, I mean, if you need to get down a cobblestone lane that would worry you in a normal hatchback, this feels fine. It does all that okay. It also looks quite like chunky and tough from the outside with the black cladding, and what has now become a bit of trim on the doors used to be the full-on air bumps. So I think on that front, it ticks the SUV box. As a car you're going to drive and live with in the city, it's fine. That engine's nice and torquey and it gets going nicely off the mark. And in Melbourne and Sydney, at least, I know the roads are really average. A car with a comfortable suspension and comfortable seats like the C4 is a nice change from driving cars that want to be sports cars and every bump jars through the seat. So on that front, it really does well. It is hampered a little bit by its transmission, which is a variation of the transmission that's used by other brands from Asian, but the way it's tuned is a bit lazy. It's also hurt by its design because you can't see very well over your shoulder. You can't see all that well out the back, and rear headroom and legroom are limited. It's fine. I know that's a really, really lazy way to describe a car, but it's going to do exactly what you want it to do. It's got a characterful little engine, and it is one of the nicer small cars to drive on average roads, but it doesn't do anything that really moves the game forward or that's going to, you know, make Mazda drivers weep.
All right, that review, you've given it a 7.7 Car Expert rating there, and that review is live now. Thank you, Scott Colley.
Thanks, guys.
That is a wrap. Will, where is the Car Expert team off to next week?
So Tony is going to a Porsche Macan event during the week. We have got the aforementioned Honda Civic through the Melbourne garage. And in the Melbourne garage, we've also got a couple of minis. Porsche Taycan Cross Turismo Turbo S, Borz's favourite badge. really exciting. Obviously, you know, a Taycan's exciting, but a Toyota Land Cruiser 300 Series GR Sport down in Melbourne as well. Speaking of premium-priced small cars, in Sydney we've got a Toyota Yaris ZR Hybrid, another Taycan, wow. And also the new Kia Sportage in base S spec but with the diesel and all-wheel drive. And speaking of mid-size SUVs, up here in Brisbane, I have got a Mitsubishi Outlander Aspire all-wheel drive, so I'll be very keen to see how that goes because I was not a fan of the last Outlander. And we're also getting a Land Cruiser up here. We're just getting the GXL. Fine. And we've also got a Nissan Navara Pro 4 X Warrior up here. So very varied garage, everything from minis to Land Cruisers. Lots of reviews coming up.
What are you driving next week, Boz?
My Jaguar F-Pace. I've been a little bit out of press cars for a little while. I'm looking forward to – I've got a – E-Class convertible over Christmas, so that's kind of making my highlight a little bit. But that'll be nice. You know what? It's been so long since I've driven a convertible. I know the Lotus is technically a convertible, but I don't think I've ever taken the roof off. To have like an E-Class convertible, I actually love that car. That if I was like 15 years older and was like a single guy, that's probably the car I would drive. Like, I would just get in it and I would just drive to Sydney for the weekend because it's just so lovely.
He's saying it's a midlife crisis car.
Yeah,
people that
sure.
Probably don't have children as well.
Right. Well, a wealthy midlife crisis empty nester car.
Yes.
actually, speaking of cars over Christmas, I'm going to have a Hyundai Kona N that we were talking about before. So we've got some pretty cool cars coming up during.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be good. Hopefully the rain goes away so we can actually drive because at the moment Brisbane is kind of flooded.
Yeah.
Oh, so you got what Sydney's weather had last week, non-stop rain.
Yeah, pretty
fun.
Much.
Mm. All right. If you have any comments at all, remember our email address, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Al Borzfeller and William Stopfor, thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.